This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll learn how religious traditions have worked for or against the care of the environment and what role religion plays in efforts around climate change. A reminder, this show is not live, but you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by Peter Tusin, professor of religious studies at IUPUI, and Gabe Filippelli, executive director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Peter, I'll start with you. How did you become interested in the relationship between religion and climate change? I never would have thought of combining these two topics.
Well, I've been interested in the weather since I was a kid, and that eventually led me to write a book called Tornado God, American Religion and Violent Weather. And that's all about how Americans view violent weather through the lens of religion. But as I got into that project, I realized that you can't talk about violent weather events without also considering climate change. The question is the weather just something that happens to us, or is some of it made worse by our own actions? And so that's what leads into these questions of climate change. And of course, we've seen the evidence of climate change for the past couple of decades all around us. And so the more I got into this project, the more I realized that a significant chunk of the book would need to be about these climate debates.
It almost sounds like a chicken and egg scenario when you mention Is climate change caused by us, or is it done to us? So that's something, I guess nobody will ever have the real answers to that. But do you think religion plays a significant role in the public's perception of climate change issues?
Absolutely. And I think that that has always been true. I mean, the climate issue has only come onto people's radar in recent years for the most part, but in terms of how Americans view the weather, religion has always played a role. And that is ancient in human cultures. For as long as humans have been thinking religiously, they've been interpreting the weather through a religious lens. But with the settlement of American land by Europeans in colonial times, scientific perspectives began to challenge old religious perspectives about the weather. So throughout American history, we've seen kind of a tension between a scientific view of the weather that doesn't necessarily posit any kind of divine source of things, and a religious view that's ancient in human cultures. And we see storm gods across cultures, and this tendency to attribute weather events to divine causation. And so climate change focuses this issue more sharply, the question of what's caused by God and what's caused by humans or natural in some sense, and how do we separate all those out?
Mm-hmm. And Gabe, as someone who works in science, what are your thoughts on how religion plays a role in impacting people's beliefs on the climate crisis?
Well, I think it's really interesting, right? Because when I speak to groups, for example, on climate change and climate, I'm increasingly realizing that I cannot necessarily convince people about the severity of climate change through showing them another squiggly line plot of carbon dioxide rising year after year. I have to also talk to their hearts on these things. And religion, I think, plays a very powerful role in how people shape their worldview. One of my climate heroes is Catherine Hayhoe, and she's an evangelical Christian as well as a climate scientist. And she understands the fact that people relate to issues via stories. And I think religion provides us that way to storyify climate so that it's not a theoretical construct, but rather a part of their lived experience. And I think where Peter's brilliant on this is viewing this through the lens of weather. That's kind of how we perceive climate, really, is the weather. And, you know, and I've increasingly used that term, changing weather, when I communicate with normal people, including in congregations.
That's interesting. So weather is a better term for folks to all come around versus saying climate change or global warming.
Well, certainly if I talk to a farmer in Indiana, I won't lead with the term climate change. I will start having a dialogue about what was the winter like when you were growing up here? What was the summer? How have you had to change any of your agricultural practices over the decades? And when I introduce that, they'll actually tell me a story of climate change. So I don't have to be in a position where I'm, you know, the professor lecturing them about climate change, which they heard on some media is not true. Instead, I'm actually engaging their lived experience.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about the basic science of climate change, Gabe. Can you give us some facts about what we already know and whether things are getting better or worse in the recent years?
Yes, we have known about the physics of climate change, what drives it, since about the 1850s or so, when Eunice Foote, the quote-unquote father of climate change science, she's actually a woman, advanced some of the first experiments on climate change. And the relationship is pretty clear. We know that there's these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They've always been there. And what they do is they absorb a little extra heat before it escapes out to outer space. And one of these greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide. And one of the products, byproducts of human activities, like the burning of fossil fuel, is this carbon dioxide. So just like in geologic time, whenever you have more of this gas in the atmosphere, the planet gets warmer. And so whether that gas is from natural sources, which it used to be, or whether it's from humans, which it is now, we're seeing just physics play out, right, in our weather. What's happened, interestingly, over the last couple of decades is that it's almost like it's turned up its volume control, climate has. There's a lot of natural sinks that have sort of absorbed some of that excess carbon that we've been emitting since the Industrial Revolution. They've acted to sort of ameliorate the worst impacts. Well, those sinks are all used up now. And I think that's why the last couple of decades we've seen such a substantial uptick in, for example, climate-related weather disasters. This culminating in this last summer where we had, you know, towns in British Columbia reaching, you know, 130 degrees and then catching fire, forest fires throughout the West, flooding in Europe, extreme hurricane impacts on the Gulf. So this is really, I think this decade is our decade of climate reckoning, to tell you the truth.
Speaking of the natural disasters and seeing an increase in climate-related weather disasters, Peter, do you think that's made it more difficult for folks who have beliefs that God will handle things to see this type of stuff happening?
I think that to some extent it is making it more difficult. I mean, one thing that we've seen is that the level of climate denialism, which is kind of a shorthand for denying that humans are causing global warming, the level of climate denialism among evangelical Protestants who have had the highest rate of denialism has gone down significantly in the past decade. About 10 years ago or so, polls seemed to indicate that about 20-some percent of evangelical Protestants thought that global warming, if they believed in it at all, was being caused by human activity. And now it's a recent poll showed that 44% of evangelical Protestants believe that humans are responsible for much of the global warming that we see. So I think things are changing, and yet religion still is a powerful influence on the way people think about weather, the climate, and the environment. And so I think that's why we still have to reckon with it. I mean, Gabe, I think, put it nicely that we're in a time of reckoning. And I think religious traditions have awakened to that, too, to that reality.
Do you think there's some sort of religious perspective that comes out of this fear of the unknown with the weather? I'm just thinking of my own religious traditions and how I've heard people in my community say, like, you know, this is a sign of the end of times. The more we're going to see this kind of natural disasters, it means the end of the world is near.
Well, sure. I mean, there's always going to be some element of apocalypticism mixed in with religious perspectives on weather and climate. That's a powerful tradition, particularly in the Judeo-Christian traditions. This notion that the end of the world is near. Now, I mean, that can cut two ways. I mean, on the one hand, if you have a strongly apocalyptic view of things, you might be tempted to throw up your hands and say, well, if the end of the world is near, why bother with trying to work to save the planet? But then on the other hand, you can marshal an apocalyptic view to call people to action and say, look, the planet is burning and we need to do something. And so apocalypticism in that sense becomes a wake up call.
We're about to head to a quick break. Gabe, I wanted to just real quick ask you about the climate change in Glasgow. What were your thoughts on that conference? Do you think it made any changes?
Well, I do think it did. I think that we saw more aggressive commitments from countries. I think that they were called out by youth activists who were protesting pretty heavily outside of the event, so much so that they ultimately did stiffen up some of their emission controls, and they're heading in the right direction. Having said that, it's not far enough. Most climate scientists know that, but it's at least an inkling that we're heading there, and hopefully these commitments will be able to hit some of these critical climate targets.
Thank you so much to our guests, Peter Tucson, Professor of Religious Studies at IUPUI, and Gabe Filippelli, Executive Director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Up next, we'll hear from a professor in the UK on what's behind Mark Zuckerberg's push to focus on the metaverse. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're speaking with John Preston, Professor of Sociology at the University of Essex in the UK, about the metaverse and what's behind the promise that virtual worlds will have a profound impact on the way we live. A reminder, this segment is not live, but you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. John, what did you notice about the Facebook announcement, specifically when it mentioned education?
Yeah, it was really interesting what they talked about in terms of educational experiences. So in terms of that, it seems that they've got this big thing about teleporting, so that people can move virtually around to different areas and different situations. So they talked about visiting ancient Rome in the metaverse and what you could do there. So they say, you know, you could experience it for yourself and see buildings being put up and experience what a market was like. They also talked about the idea that you could bring objects closer. So they had a student who was studying the planets who brought Saturn kind of into her living room to talk about it and talk about the rings of Saturn. So it's very much presented in a way that will enhance imagination and enhance the educational experience. But then after that, there was a bit about how they were going to have opportunities for developers. So there was going to be an opportunity to kind of, again, monetize the educational experience. So the educational experience wouldn't be about building concrete buildings to educate people. It would be about building areas in the metaverse where people could have kind of edutainment experiences, as it's called, a mixture of education and entertainment. So lots of interesting stuff on education and how they see it.
I feel like I can see both sides to this. You know, one is more access to, as you said, edutainment, some information and growing. But there's this other side that seems a little bit like, if everyone is on this one platform doing everything and living their life through this virtual reality, you know, what's going to become of us?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a bit frightening, isn't it? I mean, if you think about what a teacher does or what a college lecturer might do or someone at a university, you know, in the old days, it was giving a lecture to a group of students face to face and having that communication. And when we moved to Zoom in the pandemic, it was about the lecturer doing that to many students. Now, in the metaverse, you know, people are being their lectures might be recorded. They might not be their intellectual property anymore. They might be doing those lectures to, you know, a multitude of students at the same time. There's a really interesting story, actually, in terms of Concordia University, where after one of their art history lecturers had died, they continued to use the lectures of that person, and they continued to broadcast them. Well, in the metaverse, no one really dies. You can always be remixed or reanimated in a different form, which is quite scary. And actually, one of the things people say to me is that they feel tired and burnt out teaching on Zoom all the time or teaching on some other platform all the time. But I think that's probably because they're actually doing more work. They're teaching more students. They're making videos. They're making recordings. So academics are becoming more like entertainers who are constantly on. And that's really what the metaverse heralds, a kind of future where education and entertainment will come together. Of course, it's great for lecturers to be entertaining. You know, we all want an entertaining educational experience, but it's kind of a very insidious side of that, where you're no longer in control of your own content, your own words.
Yeah. You know, it's reminding me recently I had a teacher for one of my daughters. I reached out over email to set up an in-person meeting. And instead, she responded to me with a video. She was like, you can just watch my response. And I thought that was so different. I don't even know what the word, it was just like, so now everything is in this video world. And I was thinking, doesn't it take more work to make a video to respond to me versus having an in-person meeting? But I know part of it is probably COVID and stuff, but it just does seem like there's just a lot more work.
It's become really impersonal. There's a lot in the face-to-face teaching experience and the learning experience and talking between parents and teachers. There's a lot of tacit stuff, you know, so body language, which is lost in terms of the online experience. It's a lot more controlled. So there's less opportunity to ask those spontaneous questions. So a lot is lost by getting rid of the face-to-face experience. And I think what we might find in the future is that people might really crave and desire those face-to-face educational experiences. One kind of dystopian scenario is that real-world education becomes something that only the wealthy can afford or gain access to. So most people will be on kind of virtual Zoom metaverse type education. But alternatives are emerging. So in the United Kingdom, we've now got community education, adult education, and cooperative education, which is free, which is face-to-face. And those sorts of initiatives are really springing up locally, almost like a backlash against virtual worlds and things that are controlled by corporations.
You've done research on digital technology and relationship with higher education. What have you found and what got you into that realm?
Well, I was doing a project on digitization and artificial intelligence in factories and in services. And as I was doing this project, I found more and more that these sorts of technologies were being used in higher education. So people now talk about universities as digital universities. So they're concerned about producing digital commodities, so producing online lectures. They're concerned about producing online products or websites, as much as they are concerned with real world kind of products. And what I looked at is what this actually did to academic work. So it meant that people were actually working harder. They were working longer hours. As you gave the example of your teacher who made this YouTube video, you know, it actually takes longer to do that. And academics are in this dual mode. Sometimes they're teaching people face-to-face and online at the same time, which is obviously more work for them. And universities are taking the products of lecturers and turning them into digital commodities. So they're all part of this edutainment industry. And students are also finding this approach quite difficult to deal with. It actually seemed like the pandemic might have accelerated this by, you know, 5 or 10 years. So what Apple and Google and Facebook and Microsoft are only dreaming about as a future of education has actually been accelerated and has happened very, very rapidly. And as I say in my book, the pace of change is actually accelerating, and universities are finding that to make money or attract students, that they need to invest in these technological solutions more and more.
Do you think that any of these tech companies are going to monopolize the education space in the way that they're going to take away from universities who've had online courses and lectures for years, and now, I don't know, they could just put it on their platform?
It's really interesting the way they're actually doing this. So rather than taking over whole universities, it's as if they're treating universities like Lego sets, which are like, you know, various component bricks, and they're taking parts of it. So they might take the accounting function and say, well, you know, we can do your university accounts for you. And then they might say, well, we'll also take, you know, the lecture capture and we'll take the kind of interface. So they're breaking universities up and offering services. So rather than being a kind of, you know, everyone will go to Apple University in the future, it's like you'll go to university, but part of your experience will be provided by Apple. You might not know it is, but in the background, you know, Apple or Google or whoever it might be is working away. I mean, at the moment, it's the battle of the giants. It is the battle of these big tech monopolies for domination of these sorts of spaces. So it's hard to guess actually who will come out the winner in this battle, but they're definitely gearing up to take over parts of education, if not the whole thing. I don't think we'll see a Facebook university anytime soon, but we might see universities where 90% of the experience is provided by Facebook or Meta in the metaverse.
I'm thinking about how Google, for example, has courses you can take to get certified in analytics or different things. And it's interesting because it's like you have to go through their program and get certified for their specific metrics. And that's kind of become the standard. So does that translate to other things in the future where it's like they control not only the information that's being taught, but the way that we access it?
Yeah, what's interesting about that is you still have national qualification systems in the USA and in the UK. You know, you still have these big examination systems. But what's happening is that employers are more and more asking for what I would call workers who are machine readable. So workers who work well with AI and work well with digital technologies. And what I'm finding is particularly in manufacturing and services, but also sometimes in education as well, is that companies are making AIs which actually are very good at copying human skills and human capabilities. So I don't think it's that these companies might take over whole qualification systems, although they will in terms of skills and certification, as you say. You know, Google offer qualifications, and Microsoft have done this for a number of years. But what it might be is that people are trained in terms of using their particular environments. I mean, Apple are already very good at this. You know, if you've got an iPhone and you've got an Apple laptop, the two things go together very well. But I think in the future, you know, there is the possibility that our training might be in terms of how well we can work with AIs or digital technologies for certain companies. You can already see this happening in manufacturing, where companies are looking for workers who work particularly well with robots and AIs that can copy their skills. We also find it in things like travel agencies, where you have an AI who is actually working out, you know, how people are booking holidays and trying to copy those skills. So in the future, companies might be looking for what are called robot wranglers. So like a wrangler on a farm who can work well with animals, someone who can work well with robots and AIs. That might become a very important future skill in terms of employment. And if you can work well with Google AI or Apple AI, that might be a specific kind of thing that employers are looking for.
When it comes to the metaverse, do you have any concerns about the social aspects? I think a lot of the announcements around metaverses is that it's a great social outlet. You can meet up with people, you can have relationships, long distance relationships, and feel close. Do you think that's harmful at all in the future to be virtual like that?
I think it's very harmful in lots of different ways. I mean, first of all, it's an experiment in human evolution. You know, that we've always had face-to-face contact and face-to-face relationships. And we've never let this be controlled by a company or to occur on the platform of a certain entity. So, you know, our relationships are conducted between ourselves in public space or private space. Now it's a space that's owned by the metaverse. Now it's your presence there is being monitored by whichever company controls the metaverse. And what I'm seeing in terms of education is that people are getting really burnt out and really tired of this kind of online socialization because it takes a very different kind of effort. As a very trivial example, apparently there's a psychological effect of looking at your own face or video on a screen when you're talking. Apparently it's psychologically really strange. It's like talking to a mirror. And apparently it's got kind of mental health and burnout and tiredness effects. So no one really knows what the effect of this giant technological corporate evolutionary experiment is going to be. But we know it's kind of not our world. And there's something very unnerving about that. And I think it leads to a very different kind of socialization, as well as potentially polarization, which we're seeing on social media and people disappearing into rabbit holes where they, you know, find people or agree with people who are like themselves. So yeah, it's a big experiment. I'm all for experiments, but I don't want it to be Mark Zuckerberg's experiment.
It seems like there's all sides of political and cultural fights over the last few years around this issue. And there's been consensus around a distrust and sometimes passionate disdain for social media platforms and the companies that run them. Do you think people's feelings about these companies will affect their willingness to engage with this new technology?
I think at the moment it is with the metaverse. I mean, the reaction in the UK was quite cynical to the presentation and the idea of a metaverse. So, but I also saw that with Facebook. When Facebook was first introduced, there was the same kind of reaction. It depends upon whether people see these technologies as being useful in their everyday lives or not. So, and for Facebook and Meta, it depends upon a critical mass. So if I'm the only person not on the metaverse and all my friends and family are, there's automatically a disadvantage of not being there. So I think that cynicism and distrust can actually turn to adoption when it becomes the way in which people socially interact, which Meta are hoping for. All of social media depends upon a critical mass of users and the engagement of users. So I would say cynicism and distrust can turn to compliance if it becomes useful for people to do so. I mean, in itself, that's quite a frightening thought. They're actually led by our desire for, you know, an easier life or a more social life online. And we're not really thinking about the bigger consequences. And I think that I'd encourage us all to consider the bigger picture.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, is there anything that you think is exciting about this new technology that we can look forward to, I guess?
I think the most exciting thing about it is the backlash for me. The most exciting thing about it is that people might think, well, actually, there is something great about face-to-face learning experiences. There is something great about us doing it for ourselves without a big corporation to tell us how to learn. You know, like your parent-teacher interaction. There's something really good about those kind of face-to-face interactions. So, you know, those shock waves in the other direction are my most hopeful vision. So it's the reaction against the metaverse rather than the metaverse itself. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not anti-technology. But, you know, when corporations control big technology, then there are problems.
I feel like the UK is a lot more concerned than the US. Like whenever I hear stories or read, it seems like the UK's on top of things. We have about 30 seconds left, but why is that?
I don't think we're on top of things, actually. I think that in both countries, there's a healthy cynicism. And I think that social media has caused lots of problems in the UK. So I wouldn't look to us as a good example, to be honest.
And that was John Preston, professor of sociology at the University of Essex in the UK. A reminder, it's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had over the last week. Coming up next, we'll learn about the pandemic's impact on the social and emotional learning of students with special needs. I'm Miriam Sobe, and we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. For our final segment, we learn about the pandemic's impact on the social and emotional learning of students with special needs. If you want to get in touch, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now is Lee Gaines, investigative education reporter for WFYI. We're going to hear from her about her latest work on the pandemic's impact on the social and emotional learning of students with special needs and the challenges of navigating the special education system. Lee, welcome to the program. What do we know about how special education students were impacted by the pandemic?
So we have some initial research on this subject that shows that the pandemic may have exacerbated pre-existing achievement gaps between students with and those without disabilities. It's not clear in Indiana how the pandemic has impacted students receiving special education services, but we do have some data that's been made public so far. So we know that, you know, this year, only about 8% of special education students scored proficient in both math and English language arts on this year's iLearn assessment. That's compared to about 32% of general education students. And so that is 3 percentage points less than the most recent standardized exam in 2019. But big caveat here is that Indiana officials say that the data from the 2021 assessment should not be compared to prior years, but we do know that the number of students who received special education services who scored proficient in both those subjects was quite low. We also know that chronic absenteeism has increased among this student population. So roughly 39,000 students with special needs missed 10% or more of school days. That equates to about 18 days over the course of a full academic year. And that's an increase of about 9 percentage points compared to the 2018-19 school year. We also know that fewer students were evaluated for disabilities in the 2019-20 school year, and that the number of preschoolers diagnosed with disabilities dropped more than 11% from last year. So that's a sign that young students might be missing out on important therapies and interventions because they're not being spotted by educators.
Just to clarify a little bit about that with the data, is this due to a lack of educators in the system? I know we've talked about this in the past, that there aren't enough teachers specializing in special education. There's a shortage.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. For years, Indiana, and this is also a national problem, we have been dealing with a shortage of special education teachers. And so it's both, as you mentioned, a pipeline issue in that there aren't enough teachers going into preparation programs who specifically want to focus on special education. And then it's also a retention issue. There are a lot of teachers who become special education teachers, but they don't stay. Or perhaps they switch from teaching special education to teaching general education. You know, as we mentioned before on this program, you're not necessarily going to make more money as a special educator in Indiana.
You had the opportunity to talk to students with disabilities about their experience going to school during the pandemic. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, I spent some time at the Independence Academy, which is a private school in Indianapolis. It's pretty small. They only have about 40 students in grades 4 through 12, and all of their students are on the autism spectrum. And we have a clip of one of those students, Kate, talking about what she experienced during the pandemic when school was closed.
I'm a sophomore, and I'm 15 years old. And I love the school, except, but not with Zoom. Zoom was not my favorite.
Why didn't you like Zoom?
I just thought being in person is better, just for me, mentally and physically, because I like to be with people. I don't like seeing people on computers.
What have you heard from educators and researchers about how students with disabilities were affected by the pandemic?
So a lot of what I've heard is that they're concerned about academics, but they're really concerned about the social and emotional impacts of the pandemic on this population of students. So what we just heard from Kate is that she really did not like Zoom school. She said for her mental health and her well-being, it was really important for her to be in person. And that's reflected in the research, and that's reflected in the conversations that I've had with educators. So they know that there will be academic implications, of course, across the board, not just for students receiving special education. But what they're really concerned about are the social opportunities and the emotional opportunities that these students lost out on. You know, for a lot of students with disabilities, you know, school might be their primary place to socialize and to learn social skills. And they didn't have any of that while schools were closed. And even when schools reopened, some of the precautions that we had to take to keep everyone safe, you know, with masks, social distancing, that made socializing and learning those skills a little bit harder.
In addition to reporting on the impact of the pandemic on special education, you also worked on a project that highlights common challenges Indiana families face navigating the special education system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a project that I led, but was really a team effort by folks at WFYI and Indiana Public Broadcasting, where we created a digital storytelling map, essentially. It's like a choose your own adventure. And we highlighted common challenges families face through the experiences of three families who lived it. So three families who've gone through the special education system. And as a user, when you're interacting with this project, it will ask you questions. You say yes or no. And depending on how you answer those questions, you get to read and listen to some of the stories of these families. And you also get the legal context around what schools are supposed to do in these situations and also what rights parents have in these situations.
Oh, that's fascinating. It sounds like it'd also be a helpful tool for parents navigating that will see that they're not alone in that realm.
Absolutely. That was one of my big goals in doing this project. The inspiration was really, you know, I knew I wanted to focus on special education when I took this job, because we know that these students are especially impacted by the pandemic. We also know that this is an area that doesn't always get a lot of attention in the media. So that's my inspiration for wanting to focus on it. But as I began to read about special education law, both state and federal law, I realized it's this insanely complicated, opaque process that parents have to navigate. So I wanted to create this tool as something that's helpful for them and also something that's engaging, because you're actually seeing people's stories. And so, like you said, yeah, hopefully they know that they're not alone when they face these challenges.
Can you tell us about some of the stories of the parents you featured in this project?
Yeah, we featured three families. One family in particular, Gael, she's a mom. She is an immigrant. She came here from Haiti when she was quite young. And so she talked a lot about how she didn't really understand how the education system in the U.S. worked. And she didn't know how it worked in Indiana. And she had no experience with special education, which is its own complicated thing, as I mentioned. And so she has a daughter named Kimberly, and she started noticing that Kimberly was not learning her ABCs or how to count properly, despite, you know, going over that information in school, going over it at home. And so she eventually, you know, got her daughter evaluated for special education services. And we have a clip of her talking about what it was like when the school came back and said that her daughter was not eligible for special education.
Overall, I walked out of that meeting feeling defeated. By the time I walked out, I didn't even make it to my car yet, and I was crying. I was crying because I didn't feel ganged up on, but at the meeting, after they told me about her scores and why she didn't qualify, they were telling me all of these things that I could do with my daughter to help her. Not the things that they could do for her, but the things that I could do for her.
What did Gael do next to help her daughter get access to special education?
So she ended up reaching out to an advocacy organization called About Special Kids, and they hooked her up with an advocate who was able to help her understand like what her rights are in this process, and who was also able to attend meetings with the school to discuss her daughter's progress and, you know, her access to special education services. And as a result, she was able to get her daughter reevaluated for special education. And at this point, the school said, okay, yep, she is eligible. And obviously, Gael was really happy about that, but she was also really frustrated because she was like, you know, nothing changed with my daughter in this time. So why was it that, you know, initially she wasn't eligible, and now all of a sudden when I come armed with information and an advocate, she is eligible for these services? And that's not an uncommon experience. I've heard from multiple families who've gone through similar situations.
If you're listening and want to get in on the conversation or just get in touch with us, you can send us your questions and comments via Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Lee Gaines, investigative education reporter for WFYI, to learn about her latest work on the pandemic's impact on the social and emotional learning of students with special needs and the challenges of navigating the special education system. Lee, you also featured the story of a parent named Brandy and her son, Caden. Can you tell us a little bit about the obstacles they faced while navigating the special education system?
Yeah, Brandy and Caden are, in my opinion, kind of an example of the worst case scenario, in that, you know, Brandy's son, Caden, is on the autism spectrum, but he didn't get diagnosed until he was in elementary school, and he was denied repeatedly for special education services. And so his mom, Brandy, had to go through the legal processes, basically what happens when schools and parents disagree over special education. There's a number of processes that they can take to try and resolve those disputes. And eventually, by the time Caden was in high school, he was having some disciplinary issues at school. He was arrested multiple times for situations that were, you know, related to his disability. He was acting in a way because of his disability. And at one point, the school district tried to place him in a residential setting, which was terrifying to Brandy because she thought, this is not going to help him. This is just going to make all of his issues worse. This is going to be the worst possible thing for him. So she ended up having to get an attorney, and she went through a due process proceeding, which is basically a civil court proceeding in education. And the administrative hearing officer in that proceeding ended up siding with Brandy. But then the school district appealed. It went to federal court, and the court sided with her. And, you know, eventually the whole thing was settled. But this was a years-long process. We're talking about a single mom, too. You know, she has a son with a disability. She's trying to get him the services he needs. And she basically went through hell to do that. And we have a clip of her talking about, you know, that experience and what it was like for her.
And not everybody is in a position that I was in. Like, it was hard, but I was also lucky. I know that that sounds asinine, but I was lucky. I've met people with the work that I do that people are just railroaded because they don't have access. They don't know what to do. They're tired. Like, they're more behind the eight ball than what I was.
Are there any systemic issues when it comes to navigating the special education system?
I mean, as we mentioned before, there appears to be a lack of special education teachers, and that makes it hard for families and students to get the services that they need. I also think the way that the system is designed, like I said, it's really hard to understand what you're entitled to, what your rights are as a parent. And for me, you know, my full-time job is to understand complicated things and to, you know, distill that information so that it's easily digestible. And if I'm struggling to understand this system and this is my whole job, then I can't imagine what that's like for families who have full-time jobs, they have family responsibilities, maybe they have more than one job, for them to navigate this process. So in a lot of ways, I think one of the biggest problems is just lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, and you know, schools that know that they are in positions of power here. They have the information, they have the resources, they have the staff, and parents don't have any of that. So the deck often seems stacked against parents in these situations.
Is there a certain type of criteria families have to meet in order to receive special education assistance? And is that part of the problem that those who make these decisions may not deem a family qualified?
Yes, there are. So all of this is included in a federal law called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And there are certain disabilities that entitle children to special education services. But even if you, you know, let's say you have a child who's diagnosed with autism by a physician, the parents have to prove, or the school has to evaluate the child and find that that disability impacts their ability to learn in school. So it's not a given that if your child is diagnosed with a disability, even if that's a qualifying disability, that they're automatically going to receive special education services, because the school is going to do their own evaluation to see if that disability interferes with the child's ability to learn. But essentially what everyone is entitled to, the purpose of that law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the spirit of it is that every child, no matter, you know, their disability status, should have access to a free and appropriate public education. But there, you know, like I said, when the law in practice, it doesn't always work out that way for families, unfortunately.
Is there some sort of incentive for schools to cut back on special education funding? Like, are they able to take that funding and put it somewhere else?
No, special education funding that comes from the federal government needs to be used for that purpose. But something that special education administrators are quick to tell you is that the federal government has never fully funded the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, so that schools, you know, they do receive a certain amount of money every year, depending on the number of children they have who receive special education services from the federal government, but they'll tell you it's not enough, that they end up having to use, you know, their own other non-federal resources to make up the gap, because the federal government has never done, you know, has never really picked up their fair share of the cost of educating students with disabilities.
What do you hope people take away from this project?
Well, like I said, and you mentioned, I really hope that families who have a child with a student, or have a child with a disability, that they know that they're not alone, that there's many families out there who, you know, every family is different, but they're all navigating a system, and a lot of them are coming up against these obstacles and barriers. And I also hope that people who, you know, don't have children with disabilities, people who don't have children at all, take a look at this project so that they can understand, you know, this crazy complicated system. Because as taxpayers, you know, we should all understand this. A lot of taxpayer money goes into special education, and it's important that we understand how it's functioning or it's not functioning. So at the end of the day, I hope everyone takes a look at this and that they come away with some tools, not only to advocate for themselves, but to advocate for each other.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Lee Gaines is an investigative education reporter for WFYI. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.